Владимир Путин отправил на природу.
И Сергей Иванов назначен теперь специальным представителем президента по вопросам.
Иванов один из ближайших людей в окружении российского президента.
Будущее Сергея Иванова может быть связано с...
Another shoe drops, another Kremlin insider takes a fall. Another sign that these are far from normal times for Russia's ruling class. The sacking of Sergei Ivanov as Kremlin chief of staff was indeed a bombshell. Few Russian officials were closer to Vladimir Putin, and few wielded as much influence. And it came on the heels of high-profile corruption investigations targeting the investigative committee and the Federal Customs Service. And it also came on the heels of the establishment of a new National Guard and of a shakeup in the FSB. So what are we witnessing? Normal cadre rotation, a shakeup ahead of the elections, or a purge and the birth of a new elite? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome to Prague, Mark.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. And joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the investigative website Agentura.ru and co-author of the books The Red Webs, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and New Online Revolutionaries, and The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security and State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB. Welcome back to the podcast, Andrei.
Thank you. Hello.
Great to have you. So a year ago, Vladimir Yakunin gets the boot. Head of Russian Railways. A few months ago, Viktor Ivanov was ingloriously retired as the chief of the Federal Anti-Narcotics Service. And last week, it was Sergei Ivanov's turn. We've also had a shakeup in the FSB back in June that included the head of one of its most important units, the Economic Security Service, replaced. And last month, that very same unit launched high-profile corruption cases against the Moscow branch of the Investigative Committee and the Federal Customs Service. Also in July, Russia's new National Guard, a 400,000-strong force that reports to Putin alone, was established. So it's been a pretty busy summer indeed. Andrei, let's start with you. How do you see all of these different data points connecting? Do they connect? I mean, the cadre shakeups plus all this action.
Well, I think there is some connection, and maybe we also should include in the picture what happened and what started actually last fall with the repression, selective repressions against the Russian governors. Mm-hmm. Now we have three governors in jail, which is absolutely unprecedented and in a way astonishing. So I think what we see now is... it looks like these days of feuds between different agencies are long gone. It's looked to me as a coordinating effort, sanctioned from the very top. And the idea is that we have these elections very soon, not only in the United States, but also in Russia. And it seems that people in the Kremlin got really, really nervous about what might happen during these elections. And they have this idea of that we can project what actually happened in 2011 with the Moscow protest, that we can get something similar now. And maybe the idea is to try to use selective repressions against every, well, important institution, starting from governors and regional elites, and ending with Siloviki and security agencies, and to try to mobilize them, to make them more, well, active in the eve of the coming elections.
And do you see connections between these cadre changes at the very top, the changes that saw Yakunin, Viktor Ivanov, and Sergei Ivanov basically demoted, retired, fired, whatever you want to call it? They're clearly not what they once were. When they were, we used to refer to these five people, if you add Patrushev to that group, as the collective Putin that basically ruled the country, right? Three of those five are gone now. Sechin looks shaky. Igor Sechin, the head of Rosneft, looks very shaky to me right now. Patrushev still looks solid, but the two Ivanovs and Yakunin are out. Do you see this action going on in the security service as connected to this in any way?
Yeah, I think it's there is a connection between because also you should include Yevgeny Murov, who also resigned, and maybe because of his age, but still it's quite an important development. So maybe what we see it's like for some people in the Kremlin and for Putin personally, now the imperative is to try to find new people, new Siloviki, new generation of Siloviki, and to have them appointed to key positions in the government. Some of them were made governors, some of them were placed in the interior ministry, even in the administration of the president. These people, of course, they might be united by this term Siloviki, but of course they do not think of themselves as, say, the new nobility. They by no means they look like equal with Putin, and they are not in position to tell him they say ideas and to give it an advice. It looks like now for Putin it's important to have these people and to use the Siloviki toolkit to control the country, but not to have them as equals. Mm-hmm. Just to have them as people who would be happy to take an order and to execute an order, but never to try to meddle into his ideas. It reflects to me as a change in narrative for Putin himself. It looks like now he doesn't want to have, say, Politburo of Siloviki. Now he wants to govern all by himself.
Mm-hmm. So you would agree with the argument Nikolai Petrov made in a widely read piece in Vedomosti last week, where he said Putin is moving from this Brezhnev-style collective leadership model into a more Stalin-style. And I think you have to be careful how you use that Stalin-style thing, because we're not talking about shooting people here, at least not yet. But a Stalin-style in the sense that you have one leader unquestioned on the top. It's not a prince ruling with his entourage, but a czar ruling with his servants, right? Would you agree with that argument?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really telling that that for Putin it was a question of utmost importance to find new recruitment base for have people appointed to key positions. And for many years it was the FSB, then he lost touch with the FSB, and he frantically wanted to find some new place to find new people. And finally he found his bodyguards. And of course these guys, while options these people provide, they're extremely loyal. But you can't expect from them to be, say, active, to feel, to compete and to present their own agenda. They're extremely loyal, that's all.
Mm. Mark, what are your thoughts on this? I know you've been thinking and writing a lot about this.
Yeah, I'm a bit more dubious about this Brezhnev to Stalin notion. Start with that. Not least because we really, really need to be cautious about using any kind of parallel to Stalin.
Yeah.
Saying Stalin without the shooting is a little bit like saying Hitler without the nastiness.
Right.
And I don't think that we ever saw a Brezhnevian Putin
labels
in that respect.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I think the thing is, look, this is always a case in which actually Putin was the senior figure without any question. And even the sort of when we had a kind of collective Putin, it was these were the people he chose to have within his circle. That's the key point. They were never people who could, as it were, force their way into that. They never had any kind of independent power base. It was that he chose to give them this space. Now, I definitely agree that we're seeing a major process. I think I would put the emphasis not on the coming parliamentary elections, personally. I get the feeling that that's a done deal. I don't think they seem worried about that. And insofar as there are worries, because obviously, I mean, as Andrei absolutely rightly pointed out, they were caught by surprise with Bolotnaya, and that scared them. And therefore, I think one of the points is more a sort of, not that they necessarily think that stuff is going to happen, but just in case, hence the National Guard and so forth. I think it's more that after the elections, we know there have to be austerity measures, serious austerity measures. There's a 2 trillion ruble hole in public finances. And so I think they know that the coming years, you know, winter is coming. We can move to a Game of Thrones meme after I've tried all other ones in the past.
But, you know, I use that as a headline in my
piece. They know that bad stuff is coming. And this is also a point where precisely I think Putin is looking to, yes, quite dramatically rotate the cadres, in part because he's looking at post-2018. I mean, you know, he clearly, at the moment, is still thinking not only that he will be standing, but that he will be winning. And I think we can safely say that it's probably one, that's the horse to back, I think it's fair to say. And so, in a way, what we're getting at the moment is a kind of a year-and-a-half-long audition cycle. Because these are the people who are being appointed to not just senior, but often sort of second string and third string positions. So we get a chance to see what they're like, or more to the point, Putin gets a chance to see what they're like. I think that we're going to see continuing reshuffles. This is certainly not the end of it, even though, you know, obviously Ivanov was the sort of most important scalp yet. And I think that this is it. It's actually something, it's about a generational and generic shift within the power structure. But final point I want to make on this point. At present, these new appointees, on the whole, are A, disproportionately drawn from people Putin knows, and given the sort of the cloistered nature of his existence, that means disproportionately bodyguards, umbrella holders, and other members of his sort of personal entourage. But also, it's people who are recommended to him by others. I mean, the new mayor of Sevastopol, for example, sort of governor of Sevastopol, there doesn't seem to be any kind of personal connection. It seems to have actually been through people like Shoigu and Chemezov that he was brought to Putin's attention. But at the same time, of course, these are people who at the moment have had no opportunity to really demonstrate any kind of self-will. They have been deputies or deputies of deputies. However, we should realise that the logic of the system, the logic of human beings, is that then once you start giving them big offices and big budgets and big desks, they will also get big ideas to go with them. So, I mean, I think...
So the next generation of Ivanovs and Yakunins are growing up now and are going to be just as much of a...
Yeah, it may well not be how Putin wants it to happen. But I mean, I think that, you know, if we look at other regimes, other times and so forth, I mean, this is what happens. Human beings will expand to fill any kind of power vacuum that is there. So I think one of the interesting things is that over the next sort of couple of years, we will not only see Putin deciding who he wants his next generation of servitors to be, we're going to start seeing them become kind of real, more rounded and more sharp-edged human beings.
Although they will not have when we're talking about Putin's first generation of boyars, if you will, they could almost claim to be his equal. I mean, Sergei Ivanov was a colonel general in the FSB. He outranked Putin. But now these guys, they're going to be, not only are they younger, but they clearly don't even come close to.
Yeah, but stars on your shoulder never actually really manifest into real power.
No, but these people had weight.
They had weight, but they also often had precisely a personal connection. I mean, again, I mentioned this on my blog. It's quite interesting if you look at the fates of different people. You know, Yakunin, even after throwing a hissy fit when he was offered what he regarded as a much too insignificant position on the Federation Council and too small a car, nonetheless has been allowed to basically go off and do his thing and spend more time with his money. Viktor Ivanov, who was never really a sort of a, you know, who was a high-powered servant.
Who was
rather
in the inner
than,
circle, though? He was five.
There was never really any suggestion that Viktor had that kind of personal relationship. Just like with Belyaninov, the Customs Service. You know, once they're no longer useful, they're dispensed with. And then we have Sergei Ivanov, who actually has been given, you know, a fairly dignified honour.
Relatively so.
I mean, he's got a nice sinecure. He's still on the Security Council, which is a big deal. And he was allowed to have the courtesy of a story. I always said I wanted to do it for 4 years, and now I've done it. Yeah, I mean,
he didn't look happy about that when you watch that happening in real time.
Of course, I mean, I'm not saying this is necessarily his choice, but I'm just simply saying there is a big difference. There are the sort of the people who have that kind of personal tie with Putin, a real human personal relationship, seem to have been given a much, much more generous, shall we say, sort of golden parachute than the others. The interesting thing is the new generation, it's much harder to see any of them having a real personal relationship. I mean, they had a personal relationship and they brought him his cup of tea, maybe, but not that in any way they sort of were friends and could claim a certain degree of personal loyalty. I think that's the big difference. It's not maybe, you might say, their old ranks or their old clout. It's whether or not Putin in his, you know, let's face it, he has quite a tribal, are you in my gang or not, perspective on people, it seems.
Yes.
Whether or not he felt they're in his gang or not.
I mean, I felt, and I take your point, but I felt, and I wrote on my blog, that basically they each in their own way were kind of humiliated. I mean, you send Yakunin into the Federation Council and leak to the press that his car is going to be a Ford Focus. What could be more insulting to a Russian oligarch? Sergei Ivanov, yeah, they gave him the luxury of a story, but let's face it, the guy's held some of the most powerful posts in the nation, and now he's going to be the president's advisor for ecological issues, and it's humiliating.
But if
it's
you're going to sack someone,
and that's about as good as you can do.
I mean, again, I think there's no way of getting around the fact this is the person who had been the head of the most powerful institution in Russia, as far as I'm concerned.
The Kremlin administration.
The Kremlin administration, obviously, apart from just Putin ex cathedra himself. So, of course, anything they could offer was going to be a major step down. I suppose maybe if they'd offered him to be Patriarch of the Church. But barring that, it was going to be a step down. But at least they gave him as sugar-coated a treatment as they possibly could.
Andrei, why don't you jump in here? Because Mark said a bit here, reacting to what you've said. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, my reaction, I think that some of these people, new avanteers, they're already proven to be absolutely different from, say, the first generation. The very first quality they showed is that they're extremely passive in reacting to any kind of crisis. And I think it's diametrically, it's the opposite of what Putin expected from these people. So, look, we are having the situation with the crisis, and we have a big crisis with the countries, with the United States. We also have an economic crisis inside of the countries. We have the elections. So you might expect the Kremlin to try to use some methods to mobilize the elites to be more responsive to any kind of small crisis inside of the country, say, in some regions. And for that, you need to do something. And the very Soviet approach is to do what actually Putin does right now, is to try to use some selective repressions, to send a signal, strong signal to every institution, blah, blah, blah. But what we got, look at this guy, Dumin. He was the very first of this new generation, and he was appointed as a governor of Tula.
Yes.
When he faced the very first crisis, it was a very small crisis in the village with some gypsies outraged by the treatment, they got some clashes. This guy was, he was nowhere. He was not seen on this spot for 2 or 3 days. He decided to avoid to go public. And I think it's, well, to me, maybe because we are remembering this 25th anniversary of 1991 coup, but it looks exactly what actually happened in 1991. I mean, the Siloviki became passive because the idea of mobilizing them that Putin tried to entertain is the idea to, because the rules are so uncertain. Mm-hmm. Nobody actually knows what might happen, what is the method, who might be chosen the next target to send a message that you should be ready for, say, the elections as a crisis. And everybody, instead of thinking of how to mobilize their subordinates, they think of their own fates. Uh-huh. And it's not only for, say, ministries. It's not only for civic institutions. It's also for the security services. I had the same rumors inside of the FSB. Now people inside of the FSB, they got worried about the possible influx of people from FSO, Putin's bodyguards. And the problem is because nobody tried to tell them exactly what is the policy, what is the new policy of Putin. They just think of their own places and their own positions. And I think that's the main quality of these new guys chosen by Putin. These guys will be really passive facing any kind of crisis.
So what I'm hearing is that, and Mark, I know you had a piece, you have a piece coming out in BNE and Telenews where you're going to argue what this has to do with governance. And what Andrei's telling me here is that this is not good for governance. Even if you define governance in the kind of the Putin regime style of governance, it's not effective. What would you?
Yeah, I mean, I very much want to agree with what Andrei said and perhaps sort of piggyback a point on it. Yes, first of all, this is exactly a much more passive generation, in part precisely, and here we do definitely see the difference. The earlier generation, as it were, they rose at the same time as Putin, whereas this is the generation who kind of politically they are Putin's children. Mm. Also, because of the way that they're recruited, they're basically recruiting people who haven't got much of a broader experience in governance. Exactly, they're people who did what they're told. because of the deinstitutionalization of the state, you haven't got kind of clear career pathways whereby people actually get the chance to understand what it's like. They just suddenly, one minute they are, you know, managing bodyguard schedules, and the next minute then they might well be governing a province. They actually obviously have no, for want of any better word, training. But the second thing is, I mean, this is not just a cause. This is exactly, it's a symptom of a system. I'm minded that back in the sort of the Soviet times, the technical definition within the military of initiative was correctly anticipating higher command's orders. So, I think this is exactly the situation now. This has become so personalised that it becomes politically paralysing. People would much rather not do anything and wait to be told than take a chance, act the way that they think is best, and run the risk that they've done so in a way which is suboptimal or just simply not the way the Kremlin, in hindsight, would have wanted it done.
So you're forcing the entire federal bureaucracy to get inside of Putin's head. And as you've correctly pointed out, Mark, that's a very dark place where you really can't see anything.
Absolutely.
Maybe I would add one point. Is the problem is when you're surrounded by people who are really passive, and they are not ready to say to come to you or with a solution at hand. What is the result? The result is the growing importance of non-institutional actors. And actually, that is exactly what we saw, say, during the Crimea adventure, and now with the internet and with the elections. It's like you have all these Siloviki people sitting there and asking to provide a solution, and they're quite passive. But you need something, and you need someone to get to you and to give you this solution, and you get and who might be these people with a solution at hand. Well, it might be someone like Konstantin Malafeev who might come rush to your office saying, like, look, while you're Siloviki, they do not have people in Crimea or they do not have people in Eastern Ukraine. We have these people. We have all these connections. We have Orthodox guys where we can help you. And we saw this in Ukraine. And exactly the same process we see now with the internet. And I think what we see with the DNC hack is actually the reflection of the same process. When the institutions are so passive and so afraid of doing anything, we immediately got some adventurous people who are not part of any institutions, who are ready to go because they see no consequences for any actions. Mm-hmm. And because in the world of foreign relations, the most innocent thing for them to do is to try cyber. They see this growing in importance and growing in, mm-hmm. Presence of cyber element. Because these people, they are not part of institutions, and at the same time, they are adventurous. And they try to use any trick to impress Putin with what they can do.
And are they correctly anticipating what Putin wants, or are they going beyond what Putin wants? I guess that's a question for both of you.
But I think they might be even more adventurous. And I think it makes all of this absolutely unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
There is a faint virtue for Putin in that they are also, if need be, disposable. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that happens after the mess has been created.
Right.
I mean, I think just let me sort of very, very perversely throw out what I can't actually genuinely call a ground for optimism.
This is a family program.
But I mean, if there is any reservoir at the moment of people in fairly senior positions within the Russian state who actually have some degree of knowledge and some degree of capacity to act, it is, and I would never have expected to say this, Dmitry Medvedev and his cabinet. I mean, I know this is what I mean. I mean,
now you've gone beyond the pale, Mark.
For Russia wonkery, this is indeed the deepest of perversions. No, but I mean, the point I would make is that essentially the presidential administration had become under Putin the government or the governing
yes.
agent, the thing that tells everyone else what to do. Now, even if we assume that he is indeed the best person for the job, new incumbent Vino at the moment doesn't really have the authority, the power, the personal respect.
The gravitas.
Whatever. Exactly. I mean, the very fact that he's still being thought of as Mr. Umbrella. I mean,
his weird so-called scientific writings.
Absolutely. Quite. Whoever he paid to write his thesis, really, he should ask for his money back. But the thing is, at the moment, there is potentially, and I want to stress that, potentially a slight opportunity for some of these individual actors within the government, not just these kind of weird political entrepreneurs outside the system, as Andrei has been talking about, to slightly push their case. So I will be interested to see, and as I said, that's all I would push it as. It is a potentiality to see if we start actually getting ministers and other figures such as Nabiullina, the central bank chair, actually seeing if they can just use this small window of opportunity to push certain policies. They won't be able to do much, but there is a little bit of scope. If they can, it tells us something about that still a few signs of positive energies within the system. If, as is sadly more likely, they can't, I think, again, it just provides one more data point that this is essentially a stagnating system that has lost its capacity to evolve. Even if they start throwing new warm bodies into positions, systemically, it's lost that capacity.
No, and that's certainly the impression I get. We're going to have a couple of tests coming up, and you got the Bashneft privatization coming up, or it was just postponed, but it's eventually, presumably, going to come up. You got a sale of shares in Rosneft coming up. You have Sechin trying to control this process and being thwarted at every turn. There are opportunities for the cabinet to reassert itself. One other thing institutionally I wanted to jump into here. We've touched on this in previous podcasts, but what exactly went on with the Economic Security Service, with the SEB? I mean, because basically the leadership was recently changed with this. And I want to go to Andrei with this first and have Mark weigh in. But the leadership was changed at the SEB. And there's some media is reporting that the Economic Security Service is basically under Viktor Zolotov's control right now. There's been reports in the media about that. There's also been reports that it's under Sechin's control. What Andrei? Because you're as good as anybody I know on these internal FSB matters. What went on there? Was it intrigue involving people at the top, or was this an internal FSB process?
Well, first of all, these kind of things were decided by Putin and Putin himself. It's impossible to try to say to provoke him to have the chief of his service to be replaced. And well, it's not like what we need to forget completely is the idea of the 1990s. That there is some feud between security services, and they can do something and to impress the leader of the country and to get rid of enemies. It's absolutely not. Well, it's a very old-fashioned way to explain things in the Kremlin. Well, the problem is that we just need to understand that these services is a quite unique thing. First of all, they exercise so-called they are about economic security, but they have as a method they have this counterintelligence activity. What does it mean? It means that you can spy on people and control big things like big banks and corporations, and you do not need to present any results of that in terms of say criminal investigations, and it gives you much more say opportunities to do things. Like the criminal case is about few months, and then you need to provide the result. You need to send the case to the court. There's a so-called counterintelligence activity. You do not need to send anything to the court. You just need to control the industry you are tasked to control.
So it's a blank check for surveillance, basically.
Absolutely. That's the first thing. The second thing is that this service, this department was in charge of dealing with the main, say, political problems for Putin in, say, in the early 2000s. I mean, these people were asked to deal with Khodorkovsky.
Khodorkovsky, yeah.
Initially, they were involved in dealing with Gusinsky. So it's a very, say, important institution. And and also what we need to remember that Bortnikov was chief of this.
Chief of this, yeah.
Yeah, so he knows everybody inside. The problem is that it looks like if the type of bureaucracy they have inside of the FSB, Putin always is facing a problem of to find people he can trust to do something sensitive. It's in general you can see it, and because it's the only way to explain why he needs so many new institutions like the National Guard. He already had the FSB, FSO, all of his people. I don't know, investigative committee, and then he produced the National Guard. Because of some sort of, I think he's slightly desperate. So he tasked this service some years ago to look after, say, governors in regions.
And oligarchs, I understand.
And oligarchs. And also these people, for some strange reason, they also kept an eye on drugs. So it's really strange security service, which is quite orthodox in
it's
the...
It's about the most powerful branch of the FSB, right? It's...
Absolutely, absolutely. And maybe that's the only actual department Putin thought he could trust. And he started shaking the FSB. Another one was counterintelligence department. He already changed the team inside of the counterintelligence department last year.
A year ago.
Exactly. So now it's time for this department. He tried to get back control over these departments. And it's not about, say, Zolotov, Madeleine, and his intrigues. It's, of course, it's very far from me, from Zolotov. Well, the problem was, and why we got this thing completely misunderstood, that some strange people decided to say that the National Guard is, they have rights to conduct so-called operational research measures. And it's absolutely far from the reality. National Guard is all about troops. It's basically, if we are thinking about competitors, they compete with the army, not with the security services. So it's slightly, well, this picture is slightly, well, out of reality. The thing is that Putin wanted to find a way to control the FSB right now, and at the same time, he found some new people and some new recruitment base inside of the FSO. That's completely confused the picture for us, because we still tend to think in terms of... these medieval battles of the 1990s between security services,
or even into the 2000s. But let me think of it this way. I mean, not now. I understand that you're saying now Putin's driving this process, but historically, in Putin's presidency, haven't the Siloviki that were in his inner circle, and I'm speaking, of course, of people like Sergei Ivanov, Viktor Ivanov, Patrushev, didn't they have connections to different units within the FSB and other in other security services where they were playing their games? And perhaps, and I'm just hypothesizing now, that maybe Putin is trying to get a handle on that, and he's turning to somebody he trusts, like Zolotov, to do this. But Zolotov's not playing his own game. He's playing Putin's game. Is that a possible, and maybe this is one of the reasons Zolotov's name keeps coming up in the Russian press as the person who's supposedly controlling the SEB?
Yeah, that's right. And in a way, of course, say, for example, Bortnikov was unable to appoint his own deputies for many years. He still had to do with people appointed by his predecessor, Patrushev. That put him in a very awkward position for years, actually. And he's still not entirely in control of the FSB, and Patrushev had a big say inside of the security service. But the problem is that it's not only about this particular security service. Patrushev also has his people, say, in the Ministry of Communications and some other institutions. And that correct for many people, for Sergei Ivanov. It was absolutely correct for Sergei Ivanov. He had his own people inside of the FSB. So it was much more complicated picture. Mm-hmm. We have tribes inside, and we have groups of generals. They might unite for some special thing and for some economic reasons, sometimes for political reasons, but it's not about, well, agencies.
Right.
It's not like
it's
one
intra
agency.
As much as inter, yeah.
Absolutely.
So when somebody with the stature of Sergei Ivanov removed from the scene, what happens to his tribes in the different agencies?
That's one of the most interesting questions, I think. I think that Sergei Ivanov was by far the most ambitious of Putin's friends, and I'm really curious to see what might happen now. It's I think it's one of the most interesting questions in Russian politics now.
And if you don't have the answer to that, maybe Mark does, because I'd certainly, and if both of you don't, then nobody does.
No, I mean, there's no way that I can provide an answer that Andrei doesn't have. No, I mean, I think, but just to sort of pick up on a couple of points, and absolutely agree with Andrei that sort of the whole, the wonderful soap opera notion of, you know, who's in charge and this, that and the other, which is, yes, exactly, a product of the 1990s and early noughts, it doesn't apply. And Zolotov is currently the sort of the bogeyman of choice. And everything comes down to him. I'm sure if there's earthquakes somewhere in Tver, it'll be because Zolotov rolled over in bed.
He's the successor to what? Korsakov, Berezovsky. Name your evil genius.
Exactly.
Years.
I do think that, and then let alone Sechin. Precisely because the economic security division was not just probably the most powerful element within the FSB, certainly politically the most useful, it was also the most lucrative. And I think this is always one of the problems. And then this goes back to the whole business of today's loyal yes man, and then you appoint them and then you see what happens. It's always this thing that actually it is an intrinsically corrupting place to be. When you suddenly have all these wonderful opportunities, you might start as the sort of the loyal, devoted sort of attack dog. But after a certain point, you see all these sort of sidelines. And therefore, I think there's necessarily going to be a renovation. And in some ways, it's a little bit like exactly what we saw with the Investigations Committee, in which precisely the person who was targeted was someone who at one point had been the point man
right.
on politically highly sensitive investigations, clearly sort of seemed to regard himself as pretty much bulletproof. All kinds of claims then about sort of how he then thought, well, while I'm at it, why not thoroughly enrich myself?
So the temptation to monetize this position is going to be overwhelming.
That is the natural logic of the Putin system. You know, if you have a position, you monetize it. And therefore, just as significantly, because as soon as you monetize it, you're not just exploiting the position, you're acquiring more and more connectivities elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Your loyalties become more strained. So, of course, yes, when it comes to the Kremlin, Putin beginning to think about issues of control of the elite, and obviously SEB is one of his primary instruments for control of the upper elite, but also control of those who control the elite, we're back to the whole kind of who guards the guardians. Well, obviously that's where you're going to want to make sure that you have someone who isn't nicely ensconced with all kinds of other ties, but that you demonstrate that you have the capacity and the will to appoint new people. So whoever comes in now has to sort of basically be your guy. There's no way that anyone can be anyone other than Putin's guy in that position.
Now, what I'm hearing here, it's almost two contradictory things, and I guess this is just the nature of things right now. But we're saying, all right, the clan wars of the 90s and the early noughts are over, right? We're not going to see Putin's driving the process. That's one line of logic I'm hearing here. And another line of logic, though, I'm hearing most recently from you right now, Mark, is that once you're in these positions, it's natural to empire build. It's natural to monetize. And what follows from that is what? More clan war.
Well,
so what's
to an extent,
I mean? So we're seeing no. Go ahead.
I mean, I think the thing about clan wars are essentially horizontal processes. Clan wars are, you know, that you build up your empire and then you go to war with another empire, and that can only happen when the person at the top of the system is either unable to stop it or unwilling to stop it. Now, back in the day,
or finds it useful.
Yeah. Well, I mean. Unwilling. I mean, so back in the day, precisely, I think Putin would allow this to happen up to a certain point, and then when it became problematic, he would step in quickly and deal with it. I think now we have a rather different sort of political structure. First of all, I don't think we have the same kind of empires existing. These are much, much smaller. These are duchies and baronies at most. These are not the kind of things which you really would see the sort of huge clashes we saw in the past. But also, I just think Putin is in a much less permissive mood.
Mm.
I'd be interested to know what Andrea
Yeah,
is.
No, Andrea, so you wanted to jump in there immediately. I'm very interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, the thing is, when we think of this clan wars, what we need to remember that for, say, decades, the Russian security services and also the army are absolutely incapable to build any kind of horizontal structures, I mean, underground organizations, any kind of things to it, which might, say, produce a plot or coup, etc. The thing is that we have a very special thing, kind of generals and a very special kind of climate inside of the security services. These people, they might have some powerful generals, but the thing about them is they are absolutely incapable to build of building a clientele, I mean, of thousands and thousands of people. That's the fact. And that was seen for so many years and with so many generals. Like, we have this guy, Alex Ramoldov, who was the former chief of the counterintelligence department of the FSB. And he was seen as one of the most powerful general inside of the FSB. And everybody thought that maybe he would be the next director of the FSB. Well, he was quite easily sent to the foreign ministry to do actually nothing, and that was the end of him. Mm. Nobody. That's the problem with the idea of clans inside of the security services. It's literally about generals. It's not about that all people that are subordinate to them. They're really ready to follow and to help them to say to take power to do something. And Basically, it's because of two things. It's because of lack of trust. Because, well, we have this problem for years that people of, say, the middle-level officers, they do not trust their generals. And they love to talk about corruption precisely because they have no trust of their generals. And also it's because of a very peculiar way generals distribute money and resources. They never try to do things like in Egypt or Turkey to supply and to redirect this money to their, say, their subordinates. They try to do these things for their own, well, families. Mm-hmm. And so they are talking about very small groups of people who have to be in these positions, and they're extremely powerful because they held these positions. But once they are ousted, that's the end of them for many of these people. And so that's why we do not have real, say, big clans inside of the security services. If you ask me now, please, can you name me five top level, I don't know, most powerful FSB generals? I would say, well, I don't know. Mm. Precisely because of this reason.
Would you agree with that, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it becomes a kind of self-sustaining cycle. It's that because people don't think that they necessarily have long in a position to enrich themselves and their families, they maximize the benefit rather than essentially investing in the long term. It's really actually looking at the whole Russian economic system in one sort of uniformed microcosm.
So Putin, so we can conclude that it is Putin and Putin alone that is driving this process. There aren't other forces at work really right now driving this. There are no other drivers, no other independent variables.
Well, I mean, it's Putin's response to a whole series of external drivers, you know, from economic pressure and so forth.
But I mean, elite drivers.
But absolutely. I mean, I no one can make, at the moment, no one can make Putin do anything.
Andrei, you'd agree with that, I assume?
Yeah, maybe just to add one thing. But at the same time, I have an impression that Putin just have no strategy at all. And that makes it so unpredictable. It's all about, say, reactions to crisis. So if we have any kind of crisis, when Putin needs, he forces to produce a very quickly a plan. Sometimes he might be brilliant in terms of tactics, but it's all about tactics. It's not about strategy. Yeah. Well, and this precisely strange element makes him vulnerable because if you need to produce a result very quickly and you need to respond to, say, the sanctions, the economic crisis, the political situation in some regions, that means that you have these passive institutions. And once again, I'm getting back to my point about non-institutional actors. You might be victim of some crazy, adventurous people who are ready to impress you with the idea of, well, we can do, say, Venezuela and Moscow. And we saw these things before, and I think it's really, really, really dangerous because on the one hand, we have Putin in control of everything, and also, but at the same time, because he has no strategy and no independent mechanism to check the information, especially from regions, it makes him, in a way, a victim to some non-traditional, non-institutional actors.
So by controlling everything, he controls nothing. And that sounds to me like a recipe for potential chaos. And that's a good, good optimistic note to shift gears. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and zero in on one man who seems to be persistently rising amid all this turmoil. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Moscow is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the investigative website Agentura RU, and co-author of the book Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries, and The New Nobility, the restoration of Russia's security state and the enduring legacy of the KGB. I would also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Адъютант президента, глава его охраны Виктор Золотов.
Виктор Золотов прошел путь отличного охранника президента Путина.
Авторитетный генерал. Чем глава Нацгвардии занимался?
Виктор Золотов – это человек.
If you had to identify a clear winner in all the Kremlin turmoil this summer, it would be hard not to point to Viktor Zolotov. He was Putin's bodyguard in St. Petersburg in the 1990s, and accompanied him to Moscow, where his rise has been nothing short of meteoric. After a long stint of head of Putin's security detail, he was promoted to commander of Russia's interior ministry troops, and this summer became chief of the newly formed National Guard. So who is Viktor Zolotov? What makes him tick? Who are his allies? What does he want? And how can we expect him to behave in his new elevated position? Mark, go.
Well, first of all, how about I challenge the basic fundamental premise
Beautiful.
Of your
this
intro?
This would not be my podcast if you did not challenge my premise.
No, I mean, I'm much more sceptical about the idea that Viktor Zolotov has benefited from the most recent sort of shifts and changes. I mean, look, yeah, I mean, he has benefited dramatically with the creation of the National Guard. Clearly, he is a man whom, rightly or wrongly, Putin trusts. And at a time when Putin wanted a force that could be both a guaranteed presence on the streets in case of mass unrest, but also an additional factor against potential elite
that,
moves
against
him.
That, I think, is the more important.
Yeah, absolutely. Because this is it. I mean, when it came down to it, moving all these various forces into the National Guard, I mean, it doesn't create any new warm bodies. It just simply changes the subordination. So instead of it coming through the Interior Ministry, it comes through this very short
it
chain of command.
It comes through Viktor Zolotov. And this is what I mean where I say he is elevated, because if the most important function of the National Guard is to guard against any potential palace coup by the elite, right?
Mm-hmm.
The one man Putin's going to have to count on in this to remain loyal is Viktor Zolotov.
Well, I mean, in a way, what it actually means is there is one more man on whom Putin has to rely. I mean, I think the thing is, up to now, if you wanted to have a political coup against Putin, and I mean, and whatever the odds may be, but if one had to do it, in one way or another, you had to make sure that the FSO, the FSB, the army, and the interior ministry were all either neutralized or supportive in some form or another. That's tricky enough. Now, though, you've also got to include the National Guard,
which reports directly to the president.
As you're something saying, the point is, but really, what it means is there's yet another person. It makes it even harder to actually to get the full thing. But conversely, if Viktor Zolotov actually was all behind a coup, if you still had, let's say, the FSB that was loyal, or you know, any of these,
so it complicated
the situation for potential coup organisers. And it also, by elevating someone who is in many ways an outsider to existing politics and so forth, you know, Zolotov basically wasn't part of kind of existing social and other networks.
No, he comes from a working class background and doesn't really have the aristocratic pretensions of the other civil
exactly.
Media,
I mean, no PhDs about the new sphere. so it absolutely that. But I think since that point, I mean, I think the trouble is, and this is going back to what I was saying earlier about him, you know, him therefore becoming this sort of bogeyman figure. His name gets added into almost every single development and every single scandal, usually with absolutely no relevance or bearing. You know, for example, I don't think that the removal of Ivanov really makes any difference one way or the other to Zolotov. Zolotov has a very, very defined function. And in some ways, that's his very strength. The point at which he starts to become more of a sort of general mover and shaker actually is a sign that he's begun to outgrow his intended role as far as Putin is concerned.
And then he might be in danger. Andrei, how do you see this? How do you see Zolotov's role in the system right now, and how do you expect him to behave?
Well, I think in a way he used the opportunity he got because of his feeling of desperation Putin facing with trying to find new people to appoint them to some positions. And we all know that he played with the idea of the creation of the National Guard for years, maybe for 2 years, and he had no chance. Still no chance, had some problems, and everybody thought that he's a dunker. But that was, and now, because of this situation, he found a way to exploit the situation for him and his service, and he got what he wanted for so long. But at the same time, look, I do not see that he actually got something really new in terms of the positions and privileges and money and resources given to the National Guard. In terms of, well, actually, the main reform the internal troops had was in 2008 because of the economic crisis. Back then, they got, well, actually, Kremlin was Kremlin then was really, really scared. And they decided to invest lots of money and lots of things into the internal troops, precisely because they believed that that the economic crisis might provoke some political unrest. And the internal troops were given lots of things, including logistics, aviation, all kinds of things. And what we see now, well, the National Guard is slightly bigger because some of the parts of the Interior Ministry some special response teams were given to the internal to the National Guard. But in a way, I do not see it's such a big, say, gift for Zolotov. I don't quite see how he can use it. And in terms of political situation we have now, yes, well, the internal troops and now the National Guard, they are supposed to react to be the very first force to act if we have any kind of crisis on the streets. But at the same time, as I said, well, the internal troops since 1993, then they proven to be the most loyal part of the government. They were seen as a force to protect the political stability. The army was never trusted. The FSB lacked troops. And, it was for the internal troops to protect the political regime. And the National Guard does the same thing. What I see here is that Zolotov, he turned to be much more skillful player than many people thought, because he found a way to exploit the situation. He exploited this feeling of desperation. Mm-hmm. It looks like for Putin, it's important to find and to create a new structure to deal with another crisis. Like, for some strange reasons, they decided after the election of 2012, he decided to, I don't know, to enforce the Cossacks. Nobody knows why he needs Cossacks. Right. It's such a crazy idea. Why you need these people to, I don't know, to deal with what? With the political unrest on Moscow streets? Just to repeat literally the situation of 1917. It's absolutely crazy. But he feels, that he needs to do something. And, Zolotov just exploited this feeling.
Mm. How do we expect Zolotov to use this position, no matter how elevated we seem, we may disagree on what it is? What do you expect to see out of this guy, Mark?
Well, I mean, I'd say that first of all, I mean, the classic act is obviously you hold on to what you've got and you seek to expand, you know, things like the amount of money you get and so forth. He has something of a sort of a little cash cow in the sense of about half of his force, after all, is not, you know, it's 400,000, but about at most 200,000 are actually the sort of the interior troops, the riot police and so forth. The rest are security guards working for FGUP Okhrana, this private security sort of corporation, which was part of the Interior Ministry. So, you know, he may well enjoy the opportunity to be a sort of a uniformed business entrepreneur. And expand that. We've seen in the past attempts to basically sort of squeeze out other providers within the private security firm.
Yes.
So
in Petersburg, you're referring to.
Well, I mean, and more generally, but yeah, exactly. This is it. It's a very lucrative line. So, you know, he could decide that actually he wants to be a sort of an economic entrepreneur. Because the thing about Okhrana is it brings in a lot of money that also sort of basically can be skimmed. Or he can concentrate on just wanting to make sure that his forces stood up and really sort of strong. But the thing is, exactly, it is precisely as Andrei said, it is essentially a street and anti-coup security force. It is not an investigative body. If, and this will be one of the key things to check, if he starts agitating to say, look, to do our job properly, we precisely need to have an investigatory arm. Then he will absolutely be parking his tanks, both real and metaphorical, on the FSB and the Investigations Committee's lawn. And that will be the point where clearly he's decided that he wants to, you know, for the next stage in a political struggle. But at the moment, we've not seen any signs of that. At the moment, I think basically he has his new little sort of toy and he's enjoying playing with it.
Would you concur with that, Andrei?
No, I absolutely agree. But what, you know, I think there is some irony in that because, look, again, getting back to this point about we have 25 years after 1991. And look, if you look into the Siloviki around Putin, nobody remember or took any part took any active part in the coup, and they're all too young and they're too far from Moscow, except Zolotov. And Zolotov was standing behind Yeltsin. So he has this memory. He remembers what might happen in Moscow if the crowds really, and then you have the passive bureaucracy and people are not ready to act, and then you have people and crowds on the streets, and what might happen. So maybe there is some irony in it. But the guy who is trusted to deal with this kind of things, like the manifestation, etc., he has his own traumatized memory. Mm. He remembers these things.
Winning side.
Yes, but he remembers that all these big institutions, the Kremlin, the KGB, etc., they all failed for absolutely unexplained reasons. What we need to remember about the FSB, these people are not really about reflections. They still blame the West and Western conspiracy and CIA in 1991. It's really crazy because nobody can answer a very simple question: why, if you have such a powerful institution like the KGB and only intelligent people, the most intelligent people in the country, they worked there and served the country, blah blah blah. Why they failed to save a country? They never tried to answer this question. So I think it's still a big trauma for them. And Zolotov was a direct witness of this situation. So actually, we do not know how he might react if something happened.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
Yeah,
the guy's got a brutal streak.
Well, this is it. I mean, and I'm thinking of...
He's not squeamish about using force.
A few years back, having a conversation... I have no idea, obviously, what Zolotov says, but I remember a few years back having a conversation with a retired, moderately senior figure from within the interior troops, who actually had been in the interior troops during 1991. And I said, okay, well, why did the coup fail? And he said, it's simple. You know, and he was clearly professionally offended by the inefficiency and ineffectiveness of the coup plotters. They just said, if they'd just given us proper orders, none of this would have been a problem. I mean, it was exactly, when it came down to it, the last thing I want to do is to sort of give any positive sort of thoughts to people like Yazov. But, you know, I mean, when it came down to it, the Defence Minister Yazov ultimately was not willing to see bloodshed. And that was the sort of the key thing that people like Grachov could convince him. I think actually within the interior troops, because this is their job, there would have been less squeamishness. But the orders never really percolated down with sufficient force down the chain of command to the people who, you know, the colonels and the lieutenant colonels, who actually, if they'd been told, just get out there and clear these people out of the way, they would have done that because that's what they were trained and armed and equipped to do. Unfortunately, my concern, and it's no more than a concern, is that, you know, who knows how Zolotov internalizes those memories. But certainly there are people in the security apparatus who internalize it to simply as, the problem was the crowd wins when the men with guns haven't got the gumption to use them.
Yeah, and I would add to your analysis, Mark, that the coup failed because the force structures themselves were divided. Some of them were with Yeltsin. You wouldn't have just had troops firing on civilians in front of the White House. You would have had troops firing on troops in the middle of Moscow.
I mean, without
and
that will
make anybody
detail.
Squeamish. Yeah, but that'll make anybody
coups,
squeamish.
Coups rely on momentum. Without going into the sort of full sort of detail or whatever. I mean, essentially, in that first day, there were few protesters and actually very, very few of them wore uniforms. Mm-hmm. I mean, a proper coup... please, don't try this at home, kids. But a proper coup, they would have picked up Yeltsin the first minute.
Yeah.
And secondly, they would have used violence the second minute. And if they'd done that, I mean, the same way as, you know, if you look at, for example, basically across the whole country, the police force had a massive rash of people calling in sick that first day. Mm-hmm. Because people didn't want to kind of come out against the coup, just in case, but nor did they precisely want to be going and arresting their next-door neighbour. Everyone was waiting to see. That first day was the crucial one.
Mm. All right. Well, I was planning not to do the 25th anniversary of the coup today, but I guess we squeezed it in at the end of the program. That's a good note to wrap up on. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining me via Skype from Moscow has been Andrei Soldatov, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the investigative website Agentura.ru and co-author of the books The Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries, and The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
No pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian language television program Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.